Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or independent financial advisor or institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uister. For many employers, umbrella funds promise simplicity, cost effectiveness, and the benefits of scale. But beneath the surface, there are pressing concerns. Critics have pointed out issues ranging from hidden costs to limited transparency. Employers often focus solely on administration fees, overlooking other significant expenses like investment fees, which can leave their staff worse off financially. There's also the question of who truly benefits from economies of scale. Is it the member, or is it the fund sponsor or service provider? And as the market grows more complex, advisors and consultants face challenges in cutting through the marketing to provide sound, impartial advice. To help us unpack these issues, we're joined by Andrew Crawford, CEO of Sishegu Consulting and an expert in retirement fund solutions and a thought leader who's been very vocal about the need for greater transparency and accountability in the umbrella fund space. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ruan. Good to be with you.
Andrew, you've been very vocal around several points, especially regarding costs. As you said to me before, many employers choose umbrella funds based on administration fees alone without a proper analysis of other material costs like investment fees. What are the implications of that?
Well, Ruan, quite frankly, you make the wrong decision for the wrong reasons. So it's probably my biggest bugbear is the concept of umbrella funds, although I've been very vocal about it, is the right thing. So let's get that clear. It's how it gets executed that is the important thing. And I so often see people accepting these quotes, so to speak, for an umbrella fund based on the administration cost only. Now, the first thing that needs to be considered is the winding down. If you have a in-house or what we call private fund, it usually takes months, even years, and there's a duplicate cost while that happens. So if it's marginal, you need to think very carefully about that switch, because quite often, once you're paying two costs for a period of 18 months, you're a lot worse off. But the second aspect is you can't just compare the administration fee. There's several aspects that you have to consider. And depending on the type of commercial umbrella fund, you may be locked into only one service provider or sponsor's product, which intuitively you know is not the right thing, and that you know, what you gain on the one hand in the administration costs, you can lose very easily elsewhere. And that is definitely the case. So a number of umbrella funds also give you flexibility on who your insurance provider is. If you've got insured death benefits or maybe even lump sum disability benefits. But the key thing, if you're going to consider one cost, which you should not, you should consider the array of costs and look at the composite of it, is the investment management fees, and not just the base fee, the fee with the performance fees, with the insurer shareholder fees for the smooth bonus arrangements. Because what I am seeing is the costs of assets in these umbrella funds are more cases than not equivalent to retail products, in which case there's no benefit to a group scheme whatsoever. You might as well just go and do your own thing. So that's why I'm so critical. I do know that umbrella funds is what we need. It is what makes sense. It's what the regulator and the policymakers want. But I'm very critical of the smoke and mirrors and the deceptions out there. And quite frankly, you know, my industry isn't doing a great job of doing a proper analysis for the employers that are considering umbrella funds or moving between umbrella funds.
Andrew, in our previous discussions, you've also touched on the economies of scales in these funds, which seem to benefit sponsors and service providers more than they do the members. What exactly do you mean by that?
Okay, so The base level for me was a survey done by, I think it was the Life Officers Association back in 2010. It might already have been a CISA, or the Association for Savings and Investment of South Africa. And look, credit to CISA, they do very good research work. I'm not sure that the Compass survey was meant to be released and become public. It certainly wasn't officially done so, but it did get out and people like me got to read it. And what was quite clear when they looked at across these various administrators that offered umbrella funds is their costs were almost double that of the private or in-house funds being administered by these various players, whether it be, well, at the time Momentum and Old Mutual did do it. They got out, they only provided umbrella funds now, you know, as the Sanlams, the Alexander Forbes, there. Across all of them, it was actually more cost effective to run your own in-house scheme than it did to sign up to theirs. So that's my base level, the Compass survey. Now, what we have seen is those administration fees, which at the time were 70 odd rand per member per month, come down to, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 rand per member per month, depending on the size of your employer and the complexity of your benefit arrangements. But I doubt that that is the true administration costing. And I think that all of these employers that have gone into umbrella funds, which intuitively must have provided economies of scale, have given what the policymakers want, which is bigger size to push down unit cost. But there's been a marginal decrease in the administration charge and a massive increase in the asset management charge. So it's a bit like there's no benefit because you've pushed your finger in the balloon and it's popped out elsewhere. And I don't know the profitability figures of what these large sponsors are. But one gets a fair idea when you get their financial statements. They're making a lot of money on the investment industry, And this is really a captive market for investments. Once you sign up to an umbrella fund, and if you are forced to take their investment products, and the fees are so high, it stands to reason that those economies of scale that has seen over 15,000 retirement funds get to, they're currently only just over 1,000 funds registered currently. Many of them are umbrella funds, and active funds are only in the hundreds. So the policymakers have reduced the industry and plan to do it more. Intuitively, we know that means efficiencies and lower per unit costs. But from a consumer's perspective, I'm a retirement fund member. I get very annoyed at the fact that, you know, you might offer me an administration charge of 58 rand a month, but the investment products you are trying to give me are over 1% of my assets per annum. Now, that is expensive. That is retail cost stuff. And when you make a concerted effort, I don't see any reason why total investment ratios, or basically your total cost of money management in a group scheme, should be more than 60 to 70 basis points. And it's in many cases more than double that. So the fund member has not got the economies of scale. And I have to suspect, looking at the financial statements of these large players, they've had benefits, that there's a bit of transfer pricing going on where the administration cost has come down, but they've made it up and taken the economies of scale benefit on the asset side. So a long answer, Ruan, but hopefully that makes sense in terms of what I believe is happening in the industry.
You mentioned the Association for Savings and Investment South Africa, or CISA for short. They introduced the Retirement Savings Cost, or RSC, disclosure standard to address the matter of transparency or cost. Why do you think it is limited in its utility?
Well, Ron, I mean, firstly, a credit to ACESA for doing that, because it actually started to get people thinking about costs now and into the future, and not just a leg of the costs. But many of these players are not members of ACESA, so are not bound by the standard. And it's certainly my experience is, some people give it to you when they quote and others don't. And so unless everybody gives it, then it's of limited value, if any. And to be honest with you, maybe there's a better way of looking at things anyway, but I want to give credit to ACESA for at least putting a line in the sand and starting a consistent measurement so that we don't have these voluminous quotes coming, running into 30 pages in many cases. And what people end up going to do is exactly what we discussed at the beginning, is look at the admin fee and make the decision on that.
Well, let's unpack the critical aspects of assessing an umbrella fund. Where should an employer or a consultant start?
Well, I mean, firstly, one would hope that your consultant is adequately versed in what they should be looking at, because the consultant's no good if he knows no more than the investor or the employer themselves. And it takes time. Many of these funds are structured with complexity deliberately. I had a very interesting discussion with one of the major funds where I wanted to get the latest copy of their main rules. So maybe a bit of grammar teaching to some listening, but you have your, call it your master document of your main rules that govern the fund, and then each employer has their special rules which deal with their specific contributions or death benefits or retirement ages, etc. And I was asked, why do I want that? I said, but surely everybody, every consultant that considers this fund for their clients has asked you for these and your financial statements. That was another problem. They wanted to give the glossy brochure, not the full set of financial statements. Now, this is a critique on consultants. If you're not doing the research and background, then you should not be consulting on this. If you are no better than the client at, knowing what a lower admin cost than from one fund to another, well, then you are not providing assistance, and it takes time. I mean, different funds are structured differently, and you actually need to read rules, read financial statements, read any actuarial reports that are available, understand why a fund isn't valuation exempt if that's the case, because that could be a liability that you need to bear in mind. The thing is with umbrella funds, you're not completely isolated as employers. You're all part of a big fund. And when you have a meltdown like we had a few years ago, I'm not going to mention names, but it was the first time trustees were ever held accountable in this country, everybody in the fund is affected.
Andrew, in my experience in covering the sector, there's a solid framework that needs to be considered. There's administration and operational effectiveness. We've got investments, governance, and then application and practice. But how important is communication in this framework?
Well, Ruan, communication is always essential. I mean, it's actually one of the, you would think it's a common law responsibility as a trustee, but specifically Section 7DC of the Act puts a communication responsibility on trustees. So it's not only common sense and required from a practical point of view, it's a statutory obligation on the trustees. And there are certain things that when you see it in the communication, it's a marketing job, not a communication job. And I mean, you started this interview by talking about simplicity and low costs. Those are the standard catchphrases that sell umbrella funds, and they should be. But there's a lot more to it than what you see on the surface. And this is what I'm trying to make people aware of, is all those things are true. You should have better communication because now you've got professionals doing communication. You should have lower costs, etc. But when the communication is perpetually structured around driving the fund members towards one of the sponsor's products or doing a pat on the back for the trustees, it's not real communication. It's a marketing exercise. And I believe there should be, at the very minimum, the PF86 I think it was about 2007, PF86 came out, maybe even earlier, minimum communication requirements. But it needs to be about what the members need to understand. And there are one or two funds that do very good communication, and compliments to them. But again, there's the naysayer and critique of what's going on in these commercial umbrella funds. A lot of it is just marketing blurb and self-praise and trying to tell the members not to worry because everything's wonderful. And quite candidly, it's not. I think what's going on in many of these funds is actually quite appalling. I come across practices which I can't understand how people get away with. I mean, for example, the one of the big five funds, the last time I checked, so hopefully they've changed it, but I doubt it. I mean, when the contributions arrive in the fund's bank account in terms of the SLA, they have a period to invest them, you know, deduct costs and then invest the money with the asset managers. Now, when in the bank account, that earns interest. One would think a fiduciary would allocate that interest back to the fund members, not at this umbrella fund. That gets put into a reserve account, which then gets used to pay for errors and omissions, or PIs, as we know them in the industry, for the fund sponsor or the fund administrator. Now, the members are therefore paying for mistakes from the commercial umbrella fund provider. That's just not right. And if I was a fiduciary on that fund, I would feel that I'd need to make the members aware. But B, I would be very resistant to allowing that practice because, I mean, again, it doesn't take a pension fund expert to say it's not right that the person who's been prejudiced is taking money from the other members of the fund for a mistake of a professional service provider. And these are the kind of things that go on in these commercial umbrella funds, which really, it's paying lip service. It's not communication what we receive, Ruin. And apologies to the one or two good funds that do good work. But my experience at the moment, these are just product factory asset accumulators. And, you know, the statement of what ought to be happening is just lip service. The FSCA a few years ago, about this time in December, about 3 years ago, released a critique on umbrella funds in this country. And I thought it was very good. It's one of the better discussion papers I've seen from the regulators. And, you know, conflicted trustees, tied trustees, people that just don't and cannot exercise independence of thought without knowing that they're going to get kicked off the board of trustees and no longer get the professional trustee fee. So there's no doubt who the trustees are operating for in practice, and that's the person who pays the piper. In law, though, they're supposed to be acting for the fund members and the fund.
Andrew, that's going to bring me to my next point. What about the longevity of an umbrella fund? Surely employers don't want to commit to a fund that would not be around in a few years, would they?
Arun, it definitely should be one of your considerations when evaluating funds. And I mean, I think you're ahead of most, but it's not all about cost. So I've been going on about, if you're going to look at cost, look at all the aspects of cost. Don't look at a component of the cost. But absolutely, Ron, it's the soft issues like what is the board of trustees like? Are they proper professionals? Are they just tied to the sponsor and will do what the sponsor wants? is it a fund that in the context of policy where the number of funds are going to, you know, reduce to at least of a third of what they are now, is this a fund that's likely to survive? And so, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. There's a lot more that should be looked at. And certainly the survivor aspect of an umbrella fund is an important one.
Andrew, you've also mentioned open architecture in some of our previous discussions. What is that all about?
Okay, so this is one of my favorites, but that's you will not see in the communication, because in a product umbrella fund where they're trying to get all parts of the service, it's the opposite. It's once you've picked the blue or the orange or the green or the yellow, I'm not going to pick on names, but it doesn't matter which one it is, you're locked into them for administration and investments and in many cases insurance as well. It makes it very hard for you to take or be in control of your retirement funding arrangements. And this is part of your remuneration structure, because employees don't like to move every 2 or 3 years from one fund to another because the existing umbrella fund has done a poor job. So an open architecture fund is one where literally you are able to pick and choose who within the umbrella fund provides the service. So a pure open architecture umbrella fund, which we don't have in this country, but some are closer to it than others, is one where you are together with other employers giving scale to drive down costs and bring in efficiencies. But within that fund, you can place, for example, your group life assurance in insurance where you get the best premiums, both rates and conditions. You can place your investments in portfolios that best suit your employer's needs. And there are some that allow this. So in theory, although I would be the first to acknowledge it would be complicated, why can't you actually choose between 2 or 3 administrators within the fund? Because that would create an environment where I've now picked the fund and I'm not locked into the fund. Whereas, and that would be open architecture. So we do have funds that have open architecture that give you freedom of insurance choice, freedom of asset choice. They're generally not, well, not generally, that there are not any of the big umbrella funds. Those are very much closed and very much pointing you towards their product, and they sell the umbrella fund mainly on brand recognition. But it makes sense to me that if I'm an employer, I want to keep control of the cost levers. So if my annual insurance renewal comes up and it's like we saw in a number of cases that during the 2020 lockdown period with COVID, you know, suddenly you have a 20% increase in premiums. You want to be able to say, hang on a second, that's not acceptable to me. Let's see what the market will offer. And if the market does price it differently, you can place your insurance cover elsewhere. Or, you know, if the investment performance is lagging and the costs are going up, you can change portfolios to ones that suit you better, not the sponsor's investment portfolios. Now, that's open architecture where you keep, let's call it the control levers in your hand. The closed architecture ones, once you've picked them, you've got them, and you just have to basically like it or lump it, barring moving to another umbrella fund. And that's not practical because that requires communication, it requires a Section 14 process, and employees become uncomfortable, they don't know what's going on and when they're going to be paid benefits. It's just, it's not ideal. So, you know, a number of these umbrella funds, I think, are banking on the fact that there is a barrier to exit, a natural barrier to exit, because it's not easy to change, particularly administrator. And because no umbrella fund provides you with a choice of administrator, there's no open architecture on that leg of service. They have actually got you captive, and they can get away with quite a bit before you actually send them a termination letter. So open architecture is really on any aspect of the umbrella fund's service provision to be able to have choice. And that is definitely not what you see in any of the big ones.
Andrew, given all the complexities that you just discussed with me, do you think consultants in South Africa are actually adequately equipped to guide employers in the right direction?
No, they aren't. I mean, to be honest, I actually think most employers are misled and missold. And I blame my own industry. We should be doing a better job consulting.
Do you believe there's a need for independent surveys that objectively evaluate umbrella funds across key metrics, the key metrics that we just discussed, like fees, performance, risk, and maybe customer satisfaction?
Ryan, I think it would be a massive public service. I cannot agree with that concept more. There are credit, there's a crowd in the asset management industry, which I think try get information to the public in a objective way. There is a firm of actuaries who a couple of years ago around lock time did an independent survey, which I thought was very good. The problem with these is the either aspects, which is maybe just the asset management, or they're not regular and updated, because these things take time, resources, and dedication. But if we could have an industry standard independent survey, because a lot of these forums and surveys, etc., are just again marketing workshops, it would be very, very useful. And in fact, I think it might overcome for the public some of the problems we are having with my industry, which is inadequate consulting and not highlighting all the issues to be considered. Ultimately, it should be the client's decision, but the client doesn't make informed decisions when they aren't given the information. And I think a survey could do that.
Well, that wraps up today's episode, and a big thank you to our guest, Andrew Crawford, for sharing his expertise and experiences with us. Your insights have been incredibly valuable. To all our CityWise South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer, Vera Loba da Silva from the CityWise Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We're available on all major platforms such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Iono.fm. All CityWise South Africa podcasts and videos are also available on our website. So please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, until next time, which is next year, goodbye.